When a young employee was assaulted at a golf course, her description of the attacker just wasn't that helpful. He was kind of generic, and she mostly saw him, you know, in the middle of being attacked. But one of her coworkers had a great description, so that was what was released to the media. The only thing is, it was the wrong guy. This is the story of Kurt Belima and the man who almost took the fall for his crimes. Hi friends, I'm Katie, and this is Katie Does Crime. Thank you for joining me for the first time if you're new here. I'm a Midwesterner who now lives in New York City, putting my writing degree to use by researching true crime cases that interest me, and hopefully you. And hello to the usual rapscallions and reprobates. Please consider subscribing or joining me on Patreon if you'd like to hear more true crime stories. On the afternoon of September 6, 1999, the weather was bad in Oakland County, Michigan, north of Detroit. Things weren't looking good at the Twin Lakes golf course, where a storm cloud had seemingly planted itself overhead. Under the awning of the Turn Grill, the concession stand at the ninth hole green, six men tried to wait out the rain. They were eventually told that it was no use and that they should go get rain checks to come back another time. They had no idea that while they were waiting at the clubhouse for their rain checks, back at the Turn Grill, an employee in her early 20s named Kelly was being assaulted. She called the clubhouse to get help, and a manager working there told another employee to call 911. A deputy sheriff arrived about 15 minutes later at 7:11 p.m. and took Kelly's statement. She said that she had seen her attacker for the first time that day when he stopped by her snack shop to ask for directions to the clubhouse. It was at the same time those six men were waiting outside under the awning in the hope that the storm might clear up. About 10 minutes after those men were told to give up and go get their rain checks, her attacker came back inside through an employee entrance, made her take off her clothes, and assaulted her. She said he was kind of scruffy, wore a striped shirt and black shorts, and had a darker complexion, like maybe he was part of the community of Iraqi Catholics who live in Michigan. The deputy also talked to the 15-year-old cashier who had been the one to call 911. This girl said she had seen the man Kelly was describing, that he actually had really distinctive features that should make him easy to identify. A scar on his cheek, two missing bottom teeth, a dark front tooth, and a beard. She said he was with a young boy and that he had left the boy alone in the pro shop for a bit. And suspiciously, the man and his kid had bolted out of the parking lot after Kelly called the clubhouse about her assault. The deputy took Kelly to the hospital to have a kit done that day, and the next day, she and the young cashier both helped create composite sketches of the man back at the police station. The authorities sent the more detailed sketch to the media, and when Craig Rubel got home from his golf league the next night, his wife was in a panic. She had seen the drawing that looked just like him on the news, and the suspect had a young child and a truck like he did. The news story ran again at 11 p.m., and the sketch was clearly showing Craig. Obviously, I found him on Facebook because I'm like that, but I don't want to show any photos of him to tarnish his reputation any more than it has been. Craig shrugged off the news story, saying he would go to the police station and explain himself. He and his wife went that night, bringing their son with them. Craig said everything would be fine. But of course, nothing was fine. The police immediately took the "we already know you did it" route and said that Kelly had described him, her attacker, to a T. The rain check that Craig handed over voluntarily, timestamped 6:47 p.m., only made him look more guilty in their eyes. They took Craig's 9-year-old son, Ryan, back for questioning alone after his mom approved, and why wouldn't she if her husband was innocent? Ryan told them the whole story about the rain, waiting it out, getting the rain check, everything. They let him go back out to his mom. But then they came and got him again and said that he and his dad were bad liars, that Craig admitted to leaving his son Ryan alone for a little while that day. They said Craig also admitted that their golf cart was in a different location when they arrived at the clubhouse for their rain check versus when they left. The implication being that Craig drove them to the clubhouse, left Ryan there alone while he went to assault Kelly, and then parked the golf cart in a different place when he came back. And Ryan, believing that his dad actually said this because kids don't know that the police can lie, was like, okay, sure, maybe the cart had been moved. So they put Craig under arrest at 3:25 a.m. They held him in the station for the next day and a half. They did a lineup so Kelly could identify her attacker, but she didn't choose him. Still, they held him. They collected his hair and blood to do a DNA test against the kit performed on Kelly at the hospital. It didn't match. But Craig said they never actually contacted him to tell him that after they let him go, and they wouldn't officially say that he wasn't a suspect anymore. We know all of this because Craig brought a suit against several of the Oakland County sheriffs for their role in his wrongful arrest. And yeah, in retrospect, the police shouldn't have been looking at Craig in the first place. First, there's the issue of timing. Craig got his rain check from the clubhouse at 6:47 p.m. Kelly called the clubhouse at 6:55 p.m. to report her assault. It takes between 3 and 5 minutes to drive a golf cart from the clubhouse to the concession stand where Kelly worked. So even if Craig ran from the clubhouse, explaining nothing to his young son, and got into his golf cart a minute later at 6:48, he wouldn't have arrived at the concession stand until 6:51 at the earliest. And then the assault, Kelly calling the clubhouse to report it, and the manager telling the cashier to call 911 would have all needed to happen in the next 3 minutes before the 911 call was recorded at 6:55 p.m. It's just kind of improbable, if not impossible. Second, the cashier reported that Craig and his son had bolted out of the parking lot in their truck after Kelly called the clubhouse about her assault, but what she didn't know was that Craig and Ryan were doing a bit of ambulance chasing that day. See, when Kelly called the clubhouse, the manager and two other employees quote-unquote raced off in two vehicles to Kelly's aid. When Craig and Ryan saw the vehicles take off, they wanted to go see what was going on, so they took off too. When another employee came up quickly behind them in his Jeep, they pulled off the road to let him go past, and then they had sort of lost momentum and just decided to go home. They weren't running away from anything, but were actually running toward the action. And third, Kelly absolutely never described her attacker as looking anything like Craig. She said he was wearing a striped shirt and shorts and had a darker complexion but no facial hair. But when the police questioned the other woman, the cashier, she was basically like, "Right, I totally saw that guy. He had all of these distinctive facial features, including a full beard." At the hospital, Kelly once again described her attacker, never mentioning any of those facial features and certainly not a beard. And when Kelly and the cashier sat down separately to make composite sketches at the police station, they came up with two wildly different results. But because the cashier's sketch was so much more detailed, that's the one the authorities sent off to the media. Kelly had literally said, "I don't think my attacker was one of the men standing under the awning of the concession stand in the rain," and yet the cashier perfectly described one of the men standing under the awning of the concession stand in the rain. And that's the sketch they went with. I'm not trying to crap on the cops here, but it seems like Craig should have been ruled out for so many reasons. One court said his suit against the department should go to trial, but the sheriff and deputies received governmental immunity from an appeals court, and then a federal court closed the case, which sucked for Craig and also sucked for Kelly, whose attack remained unsolved for years. In the early 2000s, investigators got a little bit of a break in the case when they were able to connect this assault in Michigan with another one that took place in Pennsylvania. In that case, a 19-year-old woman was jogging at Penn State when a man stopped her to ask for a Band-Aid, threatened her with a knife to the neck, and dragged her into the woods, where he punched her in the stomach and assaulted her. It was July 27, 2000, and she was a Penn State student near the 18th hole of the university golf course. The DNA of her attacker eventually came back as a match for the DNA of Kelly's attacker at the concession stand in Michigan, so clearly there was a link with golf, but there was no person matching the DNA in any law enforcement database. The case sat dormant for years and years, but it wasn't forgotten. And just a few years ago, the Pennsylvania authorities sent their DNA sample to Parabon Nanolabs to see if genetic genealogy could help out here, like it has in so many cases recently. Three persons of interest were found to be related to the attacker, three brothers, actually. One of them was 51-year-old construction company owner Kurt Allen Relima, a married father of three. I hope I'm saying his name right. That's how the local news pronounced it. Anyway, it just so happened that this man lived in West Bloomfield Township, a little northwest of Detroit, and that he loved to golf all around the country. The cops got a sample from him via a discarded coffee cup and found that his DNA did match the man who attacked these two women on golf courses. In April 2023, Relima was arrested and charged with first and second degree sexual criminal conduct. In December 2024, he pleaded no contest as part of a deal that would lower the charges to third and fourth degree. He was sentenced to 10 to 15 years in prison. His lawyer said that the charges were so dramatically reduced from first degree to third degree because she fought hard against the authorities' use of the genealogy lab. Apparently, they wouldn't reveal how Ralima became a suspect, which his lawyer said was a due process violation. And maybe I'm being a shill for the law here, but I'm like, if you know how genetic genealogy labs work, you know how they developed him as a suspect. They had the DNA sample from the victims. It belonged to a brother or cousin or some other relative who had uploaded their DNA to an existing database. The lab looked at the relatives of that person and tried to figure out who would make sense. A guy from the Detroit area who loved to play golf would make a lot of sense for a crime committed on a Michigan golf course, right? And then you grab his DNA to test it and be sure it's an exact match when he throws away a water bottle or a tissue or something like that in public. But Ralima's lawyers said that without specific information, they couldn't make a good defense. And I do understand what she's saying here, really. If there was another person of interest who made sense, she would want to look into that person, track their whereabouts on the day of the assault, maybe argue that Ralima had consensual sex with the victim and that's where his DNA came from, that sort of thing. But I have also just a little bit of a hard time caring how he was caught since he didn't contest the charges. I know that pleading no contest means he didn't technically admit his guilt, but also he totally admitted his guilt in my mind. Sorry, I'm sort of kidding. Sort of. Craig Rubel, who was falsely accused of the crime back in 1999, says he's at peace with what happened now because the cops were just doing their job, but he said it was like a bad dream at the time. He and his son talk about their police interrogations from time to time, but he's mostly just grateful that they got the right guy in the end and that the victim finally got justice. As of June 2025, a Pennsylvania DA has started the extradition process to get Ralima to face charges there. Authorities believe he may have been visiting his younger brother, a student at Penn State, when he attacked the jogger on the golf course. In the meantime, that victim has filed a civil case against him in addition to the criminal trial he could face. He says he's bankrupt and doesn't have anything to pay her. Poor guy. Now, an interesting thing that came out after his arrest is that allegedly, Ralima didn't just operate on golf courses. An anonymous source says that Ralima invested in three strip clubs in Toledo, Ohio, without his wife's knowledge. And he would use his status as an owner to solicit sexual favors there. A former manager at one of the clubs said he would warn the dancers that Ralima was aggressive and would try to force them into sex if he got them alone. He allegedly ripped off the clothes of one dancer in a back room in 2016. So maybe you were thinking, oh, these initial assaults happened back in 1999 and 2000. Surely he changed once he got married and opened his business and became a volunteer at his kid's soccer club. But if this story about the dancer is true, maybe he didn't change at all. Investigators are asking victims who were assaulted near golf courses to come forward and see if any more dots can be connected. Thank you for tuning into my podcast episode. I'm just a true crime fan like you are, and I really appreciate you taking a chance on me. Please subscribe and tell a friend if you like spending this time together. You can also find me on YouTube in the flesh by searching Katie Does Crime.